We brought you one historian's point of view about the promise of statehood last week on the holiday. Today, we hear a different view. We talked to Dean Saranilio, Associate Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He wrote a book, Unsustainable Empire, Alternative Histories of Hawaii Statehood. He took part in a statehood forum over the weekend.
If you actually look at the archive and examine the specific kind of key moments leading up to 1959, so whether we're looking at 1893 and the U.S. military-backed overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, and you know, obviously it's not kind of controversial to say that, given that the United States apologized for their involvement in the overthrow in 1993. So when you look at that moment, I was sort of interested in looking at the Hawaiian Bureau of Information, which was a kind of like a kind of propaganda commission that was charged with achieving the annexation of Hawaii to the United States. In 1893, it's also a moment where the United States is in a major economic crisis, right? So there were like hundreds of banks that were closed. There were millions of people who were unemployed. And at the time, Secretary of State Walter Grisham, you know, even makes the argument that what he believed was going on wasn't necessarily just kind of labor protests and labor unrest, but he argued that what was happening was symptomatic of revolution, right? So he's saying this in the 1890s. And when you look at what Grisham is doing and what Blaine, what Benjamin Harrison is doing, the president at the time, Harrison was interested in Hawaii because he viewed Hawaii as stepping stones to markets in Asia, specifically in China. And he believed that if Hawaii were to become a part of the United States, that they could use Hawaii as coaling stations to gain access. And eventually, in 1898, you also have Samoa and Guam or Guam and the Philippines. But it was largely a result of economic depression. So it wasn't necessarily the United States sort of being in this moment of strength and this moment of expansion because it was already like sort of capable of incorporating Native American territories into its political sphere. It was actually a moment of economic depression. And then, you know, as I said earlier, you can also look at the 1930s, and the 1930s was also animated by this other economic depression, right, the Great Depression, but it was also animated by a lot of the labor unrest that was taking place in Hawaii at the time. And so it isn't necessarily, U.S. expansion isn't necessarily taking place as a result of strength. Sometimes it's actually a result of the ways in which capitalism is sort of is unsustainable, that there's always these sort of markets that that boom and then bust. And oftentimes, as was the case in the 1890s and then in the kind of sort of 1930s, which is the moment where Hawaii elites have a genuine movement for statehood, it's sometimes not these moments of strength, but sometimes these moments where the state is relying on projects of imperialism in order to make up for the kinds of inadequacies of the economy at the time.
John Rosa talked about a time of hope and fear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see that too?
Yeah, I definitely see that. You know, you can look at even, for instance, Reverend Abraham Akaka's sermon, which is a sermon that is oftentimes talked about when statehood is brought up. And, you know, there was a sermon that Reverend Akaka gave at Kauai Ha'o Church in 59, soon after Hawaii is admitted as a U.S. state. And in it, he's talking about the power of aloha. But he also acknowledges Hawaiians who viewed statehood as a kind of moment of despair, where he says that there's concern that with statehood, Hawaii will be turned into one big spiritual graveyard, right? That things will be sort of commodified and things will be bought and sold, but that the situation, the sort of heart and soul of Hawaii could be potentially lost. And I think you kind of see that crisis taking place today, like whether we're talking about Mauna Kea, right, whether we're talking about the ways in which Hawaiian sacred places are themselves, you know, under threat, and that sort of threat is facilitated by the governor or by the president of the University of Hawaii. I think those kinds of situations are themselves systemic and structural, and we are all in Hawaii really fortunate that we have Kanaka Maoli Kia'i protectors who are willing to courageously put themselves on the line to protect these particular places, not as inanimate places or as places that are sort of seen as real estate or as property, but instead as family, actually seen as places from which they need to be protected, because these are places from which life itself emerges from. And so I think with statehood, you had a lot of these different kinds of things. And the other thing I would say about statehood is that, you know, there's sometimes an assumption that the discussion around 1893, the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom, the U.S. military-backed overthrow, that history doesn't emerge until the 1970s with a lot of kind of Hawaiian protests, whether it's like via Ko'olawe or, you know, kind of leading to 1993 or 1998. But actually, like, if you look at the record, you know, you have a lot of people who were writing about the history of the overthrow in the decades prior to 1959. So, you know, one person that I write about in the book is a woman named Kathleen Dickinson Mellon, who is from Virginia. She moves to Hawaii, I believe in the 1920s. And when she's in Hawaii, she starts to ask the question, how did Hawaii become a part of the United States? And so she does a lot of reading. But she ends up also being in conversation with Hawaiian women like Abigail Kawananakoa or Alice Kamakila Campbell or Mary Kavena Puku'i. And in conversation with them, she hears another history. She hears the Hawaiian opposition to the overthrow, the Hawaiian opposition to annexation. She even writes about the Kū'e petitions, which are the petitions in 1897, where 38,000 Hawaiians actually signed these petitions opposing annexation and opposing U.S. citizenship. So that history is sort of all there. And, you know, Abigail Kawananakoa and Kamakila Campbell, they're the daughters of Abigail Kuehilani Waipinepine Campbell, who in 1897 organized the Kū'e petitions, right? So, so Kathleen Mellon ends up learning this other kind of history, and she writes four books in the 1940s and 1950s, and also writes a number of articles prior to, specifically in 1957 and 1958. So she writes these four books, but the last book is specifically talking about the 1893 overthrow. And so in the years prior to statehood, the overthrow and the annexation and the question of the United States legitimacy over Hawaii is under question. And that's sort of a kind of history that I think many of us are not familiar with. It's definitely something I wasn't familiar with. And the fact that you have Hawaiians opposing statehood and citing the history of the U.S. overthrow and illegal annexation, I think is something that we should all pay attention to. And I think it gives us new insight into thinking through the question of the promise of statehood.
We have had different conversations about what's happening there on Mauna Kea, and then also reflecting back to statehood and the wrongs over the years in Hawaiian history. So is there any takeaway?
It's bizarre. It's sort of like seeing history repeat itself. So Lauren A. Thurston, your listeners are probably, some of them might be familiar with him. He's a third generation descendant of some of the first American missionaries to Hawaii. And he's one of the sort of orchestrators of the 1893 overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom. And so after he participates in that overthrow, 10 months later, he's actually in Chicago at the World's Columbian Exposition. And so that Columbian Exposition was sort of celebrating the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus's so-called discovery of the Americas and the successful settlement of the United States, right? The kind of the ways in which 1890 is sort of imagined as the moment where the frontier has closed. And so he's there, and he's managing what was called the Kilauea Cyclorama. And the Kilauea Cyclorama was this 400-foot wide, I think five-story high, landscape painting of Kilauea Crater. And it was designed to kind of circle the viewer and give the impression of actually standing in the crater. And the reason why it's of relevance to what's taking place at Mauna Kea is that a lot of the ways in which Mauna Kea is being framed is that it's this division between Hawaiian culture and science. And Hawaiians are sometimes being pitted as being sort of anti-science for wanting to protect Mauna Kea. That has relevance to the Columbian Exposition and Thurston's Cyclorama because, for instance, the Cyclorama, when you walked into the Cyclorama, Pele, there was a statue of Pele, and it was 25 feet tall, and it stood above the entrance, and it was supposed to give you this feeling of being under threat, like this luminous woman who's sort of, she's 25 feet tall, and she's herself kind of looming over the entrance. And when you walk inside the Cyclorama and you look at the landscape painting, the painter actually painted a geologist walking and studying within the crater. So you would walk in and you would feel this kind of threat of Pele, and then a geologist would give you scientific facts about the crater. And Thurston placed large U.S. flags at the top of the Cyclorama because he was using the Cyclorama as a kind of advertisement for annexation. So this is prior to U.S. sovereignty over Hawaii or U.S. control over Hawaii. And so he's trying to use the Cyclorama to kind of win public opinion in favor of annexation. But what you see him doing is he's positioning Hawaiian culture and making the argument that, in that case, white settlers had a more sophisticated scientific knowledge over the crater, and thus they were more deserved over that place, right? So he's, in that example, they're positioning Hawaiians as themselves being kind of anti-science. And what I think is important about that example is that it's not actually a juxtaposition of science versus Hawaiian culture, because Thurston is representing Hawaiian culture on Hawaiian's behalf at the exposition, right? It's actually two representations being set by the same racist imagination. It's two representations. It's a representation of Hawaiian culture and a representation of oneself. And it's not actually a juxtaposition. And so you can kind of see how that kind of minimizing or casting Hawaiian culture as being either unsophisticated or as being kind of primitive, right, is itself working in a favor of Thurston and others. And you see that kind of play out in the 30-meter telescope. But I would just also say that, you know, the work of Kealani Cook, you know, he actually looks at the exhibit that Hawaiians wanted to use at the Columbian Exposition. And one of the things that they did was they wanted to talk about Hawaiians' contribution to the international scientific movement. So even in 1893, you have Hawaiians from Hawaii, when Hawaii is an internationally recognized nation, who wanted to contribute to the conversation about science in the world. And that contribution ends up being usurped by Thurston, and the representation of Hawaiians instead is that of this kind of like Cyclorama. And so I think there's like ways in which, looking at these historical moments, you can see how these tropes don't necessarily go away. And in the same way that the Cyclorama 100 years later is itself irrelevant, the 30-meter telescope 100 years from now will itself also be irrelevant. But the question of desecration itself will always remain present. And so there's certain things that I think we can look to in these different kinds of examples that kind of help us to enforce. They don't necessarily like give us a prescription to the current moment, but they definitely help to inform our understanding of these different kinds of tropes that come at the expense of Kanaka Maoli.
That was Associate Professor Dean Saranelio, faculty member at NYU, reflecting on statehood.